The average American commuter spends a total of 38 hours in traffic per year, which amounts to $70 billion per year in time wasted. Between 1989 and 2013, the U.S. had nearly 600 bridge failures, and in 2013, 24% of our bridges were deemed structurally deficient. And delayed or canceled flights cost the economy an estimated $40 billion a year. In her latest book, Move, Putting America's Infrastructure Back in the Lead, Harvard University business professor Rosabeth Moss Cantor looks into why Americans are stuck on congested roads, delayed flights, and clogged railways, and what might be necessary to break through the gridlock in Washington, D.C. It's published by W.W. Norton. I'm very pleased it has brought Rosabeth Moss Cantor to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You write that nearly every issue, business, employment, regional development, has a transportation and infrastructure angle. In what ways does infrastructure directly affect these areas?
Everything. Well, first of all, jobs, of course, because people commute to work. That's the biggest use of the highways, is people commuting to work. So the time spent in traffic matters to people. Access to jobs. There's an inequality angle. So people stuck in neighborhoods that don't have great public transportation and can't afford cars can't get to jobs. There's health. We breathe polluted air. It's not good for our health. People who live near highways have some health risks that don't happen to other people. The environment. Transportation is responsible for the second highest proportion of greenhouse gas emissions in America. So every issue we care about, including the future, whether we build the future, the jobs of the future, whether we use technology in smart ways, it all comes down to transportation. And yet we have let the infrastructure go for such a long time.
It used to be the envy of the world. Why has the United States lagged so far behind in comparison to Europe and Asia?
Well, we made huge investments earlier in our history and after World War II. And the biggest investment we made after World War II was the interstate highway system. And that was when we were at the peak of our economic power. We were building after the war. We were victorious. Other countries were still rebuilding from the war. But we didn't invest since. We let it go. We built, and then we didn't invest in repairing and renewing. Similarly, Sputnik, the space race, invested a lot in aviation technology, but didn't invest in airports. We did the things that were good for defense, but not necessarily good for the nation.
President Eisenhower signed the Federal Aid Highway Act into law on June 29, 1956, and the original authorization was $25 billion for the construction of 41,000 miles of interstate highway system over a 10-year period. It was the largest public works project in American history through that time, and that was a Republican administration's bill. What's happened to change his party's attitude since?
Well, I don't think it's just one party, although certainly the Republicans have been most reluctant to invest, but not all of them.
Well, they say it's a tax thing.
They say it's a tax thing, and there isn't a trust that government can do anything in the same way that we could mobilize as well. Remember that in 1956, I mean, President Eisenhower had also been General Eisenhower, and there was a great belief in what the military could do and the engineers that came out of the military. Now there is not a belief in government or anything that government touches that it's not going to be as good as what the private sector does. And the recent train crash, very sad train crash in Philadelphia that killed five people and
six now.
Oh, it's worse. And injured dozens and dozens more. That it will be attributed in some people's mind to, well, Amtrak is a government corporation, and so we don't believe in government. And so Congress has been trying to slash funds for Amtrak.
But Amtrak was created under the Nixon administration, and I recently had a guest on who said that it was designed to fail. It's amazing that it's lasted as long as it has, and in recent years has become something of a success. More people now use it to go between Boston, New York, and Washington than fly. 20 years ago, it was the other way around. So with that success, you would think that the service would be improved.
One would think. Well, the set up to fail. The design of Amtrak was not one that was going to make let it be nimble and innovative, because it's a government bureaucracy subject to a lot of rules.
But it's a for-profit operation, although it never makes a profit.
Well, it actually seems to be profitable on the Northeast Corridor, even though it isn't the rest of the country. But it has to provide, it's a universal service model, has to provide long-distance rail in other parts of the country as well. But on the Northeast Corridor, it seems to be, if you look deeply at the numbers, it seems to be profitable, and people are riding it because the highways are clogged. However, if we don't invest in the basic infrastructure on which it rides, the highways get more clogged, because when it breaks down, people take to their cars. And the other thing is, it's supposed to be high speed. So the Acela was a great triumph of the Clinton administration, high speed rail, and it can't get up to its highest speed except on a very short stretch in Massachusetts and Rhode Island. And it's still a lot slower, even at top speed, than trains in Japan, China, and Europe.
And when it's been proposed that we have high speed rail here, many states have decided they don't want it.
No, but California does seem to want it. It's very expensive, I will say that. It's very, very expensive compared to certain innovations in maintaining and upgrading Amtrak, which are a lot cheaper.
But did Japan find it too expensive? Did the French find it too expensive when they put in their high-speed rail?
They were much more readier to invest at the national level. But we do have sources of investment. We actually have, because, you know, my book is a little, tries to find sources of hope, because we could all get so miserable we decide to stay home and do nothing. But the hope is that if we can show improvements, even modest improvements, it attracts private investors. And right now there are two private companies willing to put in their own money for high-speed rail. One is in Texas, Texas Central, Dallas to Houston. Another one is in Florida. All aboard America, Miami, high-speed rail, Miami-Orlando. And so good, they're putting in a terminal, and the people favoring public transit, light rail in Miami, want to use that terminal for a connection point. So that's win-win. That's like the private sector stepping in because they believe.
And then Elon Musk has this almost science fiction kind of proposal for high-speed rail in California.
Yes, Elon Musk's idea. I believe in him because the Tesla seems to be working well. It's a great car, and it looks like he's going to get battery technology to make it possible for more people to use electric cars. He has this image of a Hyperloop where the train is sort of in enclosed loop and goes really, really fast. I mean, it does seem science fiction-y, but then so did flight when the Wright brothers first flew. We need that kind of imagination. I love the entrepreneurs who are thinking about transportation. I talk about a Massachusetts company called Terrafugia making a flying car, and they actually have the prototype, and they have 100 orders. It's expensive, but why not imagine? Why not dream again?
Especially on the Van Wyck Expressway when you're trying to make it to the airport on time.
I keep feeling if we could only have a car that could somehow take off like a helicopter above the traffic. In fact, the flying car is now classified as an aircraft, so it can only really operate on a runway. But the technology could be there, and I feel one other problem, and Amtrak, I said before, got bogged in bureaucracy. It's a government corporation. We don't have the entrepreneurs who are dreaming of new technology at the table in all the discussions about funding or about the future of regions, and they should be, because they're the ones who are using digital technologies in ways that could transform our lives. They are. Uber already is transforming our lives.
My guest is Elizabeth Moss Cantor.
Rosebeth,
I'm sorry, who holds the Ernest L. Arbuckle Professorship at Harvard Business School and is chair and director of the Harvard University Advanced Leadership Initiative. Her latest book is MOVE, Putting America's Infrastructure Back in the Lead. So have we just been applying bandages up until now?
Pretty much. We have some innovation. We have innovation in air traffic control, but it's also slow to get it deployed. I would hear about a fabulous new way to do something like planes that can glide on landing, which saves noise, among other things, saves fuel, and also is better for the neighborhood. And it still can take the FAA 10 years before it gets everywhere. So we're very slow moving sometimes. It's a little bit of a drama, tug of war between the entrepreneur and the bureaucrat in America. We love innovation, but we often don't know how to deploy it fast enough.
How much of this is a matter of the money involved? You mentioned the expense of high-speed rail. When Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey killed a $12.4 billion Hudson River tunnel, he argued it would become too expensive because of cost overruns. He now says he regrets having made that decision, but the whole program is killed. You write, infrastructure has no ideology, but how do we depoliticize these things?
I hope that things like the disaster in Philadelphia...
Won't that just stop people from taking trains?
I don't think so, because we don't have any choice, and I think people sometimes, for a while, some people are afraid, but people play the odds and say, well, it's already happened, so it won't happen to me. The bridge collapse in Minnesota had the country talking about our dangerous bridges, and then nothing really happened, and so everyone goes back to life as normal. I think on things like the Hudson River tunnel and cost overruns, it doesn't have to be that way. My favorite story and move is the Port of Miami tunnel. I'm in love with this tunnel because even though it took a very long time to get it approved in the first place, that's our other political problem in America. Once it was approved, it came in roughly on time, a month variance, and under budget because it was a public-private partnership. The public sector was involved in oversight and in planning, but a private company did the finance, and a private company is operating the tunnel. And already it's in operation since the summer of 2014. Already 80% of the trucks that would have otherwise clogged downtown Miami streets have been diverted to the interstate because of the tunnel. And it's state of the art. It's got all those sensors and bells and whistles for safety.
It's being called the Tunnel of Tomorrow. So you're saying that every city should have one?
Well, I don't know if every city needs a tunnel exactly. They may need bridges. They may need overpasses. They may need to get rid of the places on the street where the train tracks cross the street. You know, different cities need different things. So one of my arguments is federal funding, a federal vision, national leadership, but regional planning and implementation.
You suggest that part of the problem is that the topic of infrastructure doesn't sizzle. It sounds technical, inanimate, and bureaucratic. Well, how do we change the way that it is discussed in America?
I think we have to make it human and talk about the human consequences. We all live with it every day. It affects every aspect of our life. It's a big part of the average family budget. The average family of four spends up to 20%. One study showed 19%. Another study showed 11% of the family budget is spent on this. So it's absolutely critical. But people take for granted that all they've got is what's around them. There is a huge interest in America in more and better public transportation as more people are crowded into cities and want to be in cities, as young professionals go to cities, often don't even have driver's licenses, let alone own a car. They want public transportation. Sometimes subway stops are used for parties. And I mean that literally, like the city will throw a celebration in a new subway stop. But so do business leaders want public transportation. They know their employees have to be able to get to work. So we have a lot of people who have needs and for whom this is essential, but have maybe given up hope that we could do anything about it. They've watched They watch Congress basically do nothing. They put little patches on the Highway Trust Fund so that potholes get repaired. And some neighborhoods get more attention than other neighborhoods.
You suggest that technology can change our roads and the way that people drive. What are smart roads? Can they actually fix potholes?
Well, the road itself doesn't fix the pothole, but it can notify the city really fast when the pothole needs fixing.
A thing called street bump?
Well, street bump was an innovation. City of Boston, which does prove, by the way, that not all government is bureaucratic. Boston's being very innovative. And their urban mechanics lab has been responsible for a number of apps. One is Street Bump, where your car, if it's wired, if it's connected via your smartphone, tells the city that the road needs repair because of the vibrations from the car. So you don't even have to tell them. The car tells them. That's fantastic. Finding parking. It turns out that parking, looking for parking, is one of the biggest sources of pollution as well as congestion. In Brooklyn, there was a study that showed that 45% of the pollution was from people looking for parking. Parking apps that can get people to parking right away will save so many social costs as well as real financial costs.
That's called smart parking?
Smart parking.
But how can technology reduce traffic on the roads? GPS doesn't seem to be sending me into the roads that have less traffic.
Although Google now has some of their systems will tell you that you should reroute because of the traffic. But what technology will help do, first of all, is sometimes traffic management, and this does get a little technical, but traffic management to keep the cars flowing smoothly because of when the lights are spaced, et cetera, through sensors in roads that operate over wireless networks, that can help. The other thing that can help is getting cars off the roads by using alternatives. So a few alternatives. One is things like diverting the trucks. The trucks go somewhere else. Sending things that would be sent by truck by rail instead, which make at least the highways a little bit better for cars. Every time I'm on the Connecticut Turnpike and you feel in a little car like you're jammed between all these enormous 18-wheeler trucks, if what they were carrying was going by rail, that would help. And then another thing that helps are all the new services that your smartphone makes possible, which means you don't have to own a car. You could get your Zip car, your shared car, and your smartphone will help unlock it, and you just take it, and then you leave it where you need to leave it, or summon a ride-sharing service. Uber's the one that's gotten the most attention. Summon a private bus. There's a new private bus service that promises to pick up people, tell them where to be, with no less than a 5-minute walk from where they are, and they can get routed to where they want to be. And they're using data to predict the routes that people want to ride on.
The MTA has an app that will tell you when the next bus is due at the station, the bus station stop that you're standing at. The problem is it only works sometimes.
That's a problem I heard everywhere. We interviewed in 6 cities people who were dependent on public transportation, and the stories were hair-curling. They said, well, yes, even if we have the data and the system, the data aren't always right, or the bus decides to go past because the bus driver's behind. In certain neighborhoods, sometimes the drivers don't finish their routes at night because they figure no one will know. So the state of public transportation is not very good, even though people really want it. We have to put an emphasis on making it safe, convenient, rider-friendly.
We're seeing more and more car manufacturers equipping vehicles with software and wireless networks. So that's the other side. That's the private sector helping us in these areas?
So this is definitely growing. I mean, cars, the value of cars increasingly is not going to be the metal. It's going to be the software. And Google thinks that it's in the auto business.
With a driverless car, is that going to change things?
Well, it certainly is, because whether or not we have fully driverless cars, imagine going down the road and you look in the car next to you and there's nobody there, you know, that is not yet something we're comfortable with. But more forms of automation help. For example, cars would not just flash or make a little beep if you're too close to the car next to you, it would actually stay in lane. And that would mean also that the smart road is sending some signals about where the car is. So I'm a great believer in the potential of all of those technologies to make it safer, more convenient, greener, and have fewer cars altogether on the road.
My guess is Rosabeth Moss Kanter, whose follow-up to her bestseller Confidence is Move, Putting America's Infrastructure Back in the Lead, published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned that one of the ways that we can get rid of some of the truck congestion is to ship more things by rail. We talked earlier about how passenger service by rail has deteriorated, but for some reason, American freight rail service has thrived and actually become more efficient?
Freight rail actually turns out to be an American strength. And there are claims by the freight rail companies that it's one of the best in the world. And I think that's been confirmed by some observers. And at the same time that Amtrak was made a public corporation and went on its way toward some improvements, but now the sad state of the infrastructure that I assume is partly behind the accidents we've seen. Freight rail was in a public corporation for a while, Conrail, and then it was broken up. It was privatized, and the components went to such companies as CSX and Northern Southern, Norfolk Southern.
And you spoke to Michael Ward, the CEO.
Yeah, and I'm
CSX.
I am on a board with Michael Ward, so I know him, so that's full disclosure. But freight rail, a company like CSX, is actually a standout in terms of environmental sustainability, in terms of cost effectiveness. They get awards for diversity, for community service. So these private companies have taken their responsibilities very seriously.
The only time I hate them is when I'm waiting to cross a railroad crossing and one of those trains comes by with 300 cars attached and you have to sit there for a half hour.
That's something we have to take care of in America, is the train crossings, the rail crossings. That is a real mess. In Chicago, it's the worst in the country. It used to be that it could take 30 hours to go from Los Angeles to Chicago, and then 24 hours just to cross a dozen miles or so in Chicago because of all those grade crossings. And that's one thing that Chicago is working on, getting rid of those. I don't think we should have those anywhere in America. That would be high on my agenda because it's a lot of safety hazards, a lot of fatalities, as well as the lost time. In fact, Amtrak fatalities are higher on those crossings than they are from this derailment in Philadelphia.
They can be quite dangerous. The New York Times reported that New Jersey has one of the most dangerous situations. Cars can get trapped between the gates.
That's a shame, because I also understand that there are a lot of fatalities because cars try to go around the gates thinking they'll beat the train. Why we then have those, we need the underpasses, overpasses, and that's infrastructure building. But if you do that, you have a chance to also modernize communities around the tracks. Remember when we used to talk about the other side of the tracks? Kind of meant that anywhere there were tracks, there was going to be another side which was sort of blighted. If we're going to renew cities, that's one good way. In Chicago, one of those grade crossings, which was particularly horrible, with 20-minute waits often because of the long trains, stuck in your car and in traffic, although they could be in their car listening to you, Leonard, which would have been great.
I love it.
Yeah, but they are not only untangling that, put in a bridge that was an instant bridge, meaning it was assembled off-site, rolled into place, underpasses, overpasses, and the neighborhood around it, which was a swamp, is now being made into a park for bicycles and pedestrians. Our quality of life can be enhanced if we do these infrastructure projects and add to them neighborhood enhancements.
Let's talk about air transportation, which you write about. You say the past few decades have seen a steady descent from great heights, which negatively affects the economy, airline industry, passengers, and the environment. What changes have taken place in the airline industry over the past few decades that have affected service?
A rush for profitability. I mean, right now, we do have profitable major airlines. That's because the one destination all of them except one headed for was the courtroom. They all went into bankruptcy. It was hard to make money because of price competition and cutting the fares, and they couldn't make money. It's also the way we finance airports, which is fees on passenger tickets. So the airlines are collecting those fees on behalf of the airports. So this is also a failure to have a real national aviation strategy. Whereas other countries have subsidized airlines and airports, and they're actually competing with the U.S. for things like being a cargo hub. It used to be that Memphis, Tennessee, where Federal Express started, well, didn't start, but has its major hub, was the number one cargo hub in the world, and now it's been overtaken by Hong Kong, let alone Emirates and the Dubai Airport. I'm much better than Kennedy. We don't even talk about Kennedy. Some of the other U.S.
Well, LaGuardia, people have been talking about closing down LaGuardia.
I know. LaGuardia is another whole problem. So again, it's failure to invest. Meanwhile, there's a lot of innovations that are making flying safer, more comfortable. The weather company has a product called Total Turbulence, which American Airlines has been using, which gives pilots more data to make better decisions about getting around turbulence. They can carry less fuel. But those innovations also run up against whether they get approval through the bureaucracy. And the air traffic control system is a little outmoded. It shouldn't be subject to annual congressional appropriations. It should be have a longer life than that.
It's estimated that flight delays and cancellations cost the U.S. economy over $31 billion per year, and the FAA estimates that two-thirds of weather-related delays are avoidable. If this is the case, then why are those kinds of delays more endemic today?
So there, I think we're going to see change. This is why, while I tell this dire story of how we've gotten to our state of delays after we were the land of opportunity, there are these signs on the horizon that if we have a national strategy and we have some federal funding sources which can be matched by private money and by regional planning, that we could overcome these problems and it could be much more comfortable for everybody. But it's years of neglect. Look at what happened. I mean, at the end of the Clinton administration of peace and prosperity and a budget surplus, 9/11 happened, and that changed everything. So regardless of what people's politics are, we just lived through a time when all the attention went to the war on terrorism, the attention went to military spending, and we cut those parts of the budget that would have helped us advance these issues. I think we're coming back now to a realization we must do it.
So 9/11 is responsible for the fact that the U.S. ranks 30th in the world for quality of air transport infrastructure, 127th for ticket taxes and airport charges, 131st in CO2 emissions per capita.
Yes, those are all my data from my book, and
that's where I got it.
I know, thank you. But it's right. It's absolutely right that we rank that way. I'm not blaming 9/11 for everything. I'm just saying that national attention, we were turned to other matters. So in the 90s, we were getting ready. We were getting very partisan still in the 1990s, but we were getting ready for some big investments, and we let those go. And so it gets worse and worse and worse. And unless we now have leadership and a vision and a national strategy that gets us back on track.
I thought the airlines were helping themselves by merging and also charging us, nickel and diming us, for anything from awful food that they charge us for now, to allowing us to sit in the exit row.
You are so right. And Americans,
I'm afraid to have heavy luggage.
Well, you have to check your knees at the counter. Americans prefer flying to riding trains, and yet at the same time hate every moment of it because it's been made so uncomfortable. In the search for profitability, yes, mergers have helped the airlines. They are consolidating. There are now fewer choices because as they got out of bankruptcy, they merged. And this year, the airlines have been very, very profitable.
And also gas prices are down.
Yes. So they're not returning that to the passengers, but they could. But we do need healthy industries. I am at Harvard Business School. At the same time, if we don't have a public sector that takes a look at the industry overall, helping to make it competitive globally, because they actually make a lot of money internationally rather than domestically. It's not domestic flying. That's so much cutthroat competition.
Rosabeth Moss Cantor holds the Ernest L. Arbuckle Professorship at Harvard Business School, is chair and director of the Harvard University Advanced Leadership Initiative. She is the best-selling author of Confidence, When Giants Learn to Dance, The Change Masters, Men and Women in the Corporation, and other books, and now Move, Putting America's Infrastructure Back in the Lead. It is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, and thank you for great comments and questions.